are listening to Feel Free to Deviate, the podcast about people, their careers, and their relationships with success. My name is Jim Turbert, and I'm the host of the show. The guest on episode 47 of Feel Free to Deviate is singing, songwriting, guitar playing, creative person, Tom Sturm. Our paths originally crossed in the late 90s when he moved into a house with a bunch of my friends. He's a musician, and as many parents of musicians have noted over the years, making money as a musician can be challenging. Because of that, he currently works as a content creator at Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton, Massachusetts, but he always seems to have some sort of project for himself or anyone who will listen. I don't think we talked about it, but I'm pretty sure he even wrote a young adult novel at some point. Anyway, he's been making stuff since he was a kid, and as far as I can tell, he doesn't plan to stop. And I'm not talking about being a hobbyist. Sometimes people are quick to call something you don't earn your living at a hobby. That's a pet peeve of mine. In this case, as in many others, it's not a dalliance. Tom is all in. The episode is a long one, so don't forget that you can pause and come back if you need to. It's worth sticking around until the end. So get a beverage or settle into whatever you're doing. This is my conversation with Tom Sturm. The way I usually start off is by asking people, how do they identify in the world?
That's an interesting question. You know, I don't really have opportunity to tell people that often, but I think primarily what I identify as is just sort of a creative person. So I try to make every aspect of my life sort of have some element of that, you know, be it writing or recording music or doing any sort of audiovisual stuff for work, web management or video production sometimes. My day job is changing. I'm kind of in a sort of transitional period. A larger company sort of bought the company I work for. So now I'm kind of...
Is that the Advocate still?
No. I worked for the last 7 years for Cooley Dickinson Hospital doing all that, managing their website and doing just a whole bunch of stuff. But they've been gradually taken over by Mass General Brigham in Boston. You know, Mass General Brigham is huge, has something like 80,000 employees and owns like a dozen hospitals and, you know, still theoretically a nonprofit, but, you know, a huge, you know, the largest employer in the
Lots
Boston
of nonprofit.
Area or something. Yeah. But the weird thing is that, like, everyone there is all specialized, and I've just been this utility player out here. So there's not really a place for me there. So they asked me at one point, well, what do you like to do best? And I said, well, I guess I like to create content the best. That was one of the options they offered me. But then they were like, all right, well, that means you won't be doing any of this anymore. And you're going to end. And it still sort of remains to be seen what creating content is going to mean at the new job. But, we'll see. I mean, I do think they value me and understand that I've been at Cooley for a long time. And
right.
So we'll see. But then there's my creative life where I just sort of in the cracks of time in between that and being a dad and upkeeping a house and et cetera, I get to keep working on my creative stuff, be that finishing another screenplay or another album or another whatever else I'm doing at the time. I've made a couple videos. I painted a whole room in my basement with the green screen paint and
Oh, nice.
Made a couple of videos and hopefully we'll make some more. That's a little labor intensive too, like editing video, but yes. One of my other alter egos is Snackbeard the Pirate, which is the album I put out a few years ago that's like kids pirate songs.
And nice, good idea.
Played many gigs dressed up as a pirate with a beard of snacks. And if you haven't checked it out, you can Google it. It's all over.
I did a little.
it's great for kids that there's a sweet spot between like 6 and 10, I think, that where kids are not too afraid of pirates and not bored of them. So like it's right in there. I played a New Year's gig for Northampton's first night, which was actually, that was the first Snackbeard gig I'd played in a while, but it was great. It was probably the best one ever. There was like packed with all kids of the right age and their groovy Northampton parents. And mm-hmm. You know, I got to.
It must be super fun to do that.
Oh, super fun. You throw out chocolate gold doubloons at the crowd. And, you know, it's begging for a bigger budget, Jim. You know, it needs to be like a Broadway show or an off Broadway show. But it has a whole story. The whole record has like all this narration and stuff in between. I sort of wrote a whole vague little pirate trajectory of someone who joins a pirate crew and goes through all these things. So that's fun. So that was like, that was my last big whole record accomplishment, probably. That was probably like 4 years ago or so.
When you go out and play this, is it like the same sort of, I know it's not, you don't always play with the same guys, but you know all the guys in the scene in Western Mass. So are you just playing with some of those guys, or are there new people involved, or is it?
It's just me. When I play those gigs, it's just me. But
It's a solo act.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely, I had a bunch of guest stars on the recording, which I'm very grateful for. Some of them are extremely talented, and I'm really glad that they came and played on the CD because it came out great. They're exactly what I needed, like people that knew how to do these things, like steel drums and violin and stuff that I can't play myself. But I've done other stuff too, and then I've been doing this like one-off like dance pop tunes that I, whatever reason, just got into like being like, I could do this. Like, let me just see if I could produce some dance pop tunes. And I worked with a number of female vocalists that I just paid to learn the songs and sing them.
Right.
Most of them have, you know, come out pretty well for just this random relationship with someone I don't know that much, except for what the first person I did it with is a girl I toured with for like a year who you might remember, Seti.
I do.
That was like right when I was living in Hadley. I had had hooked up with her and basically toured with that band for the better part of a year at least. And she was the first one to do one of the dance pop songs with me. You know, she's been living out in Wellfleet on the Cape with her family, and other than just playing in the local pub, doesn't really do much music anymore. So she was psyched when I called her up. She's like, all right, I'll come do it.
I'll do that. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I think her mom still lives out here in Longmeadow, so she does come out here on occasion.
That's one of those songs. I saw it on, well, I can't remember if it's SoundCloud or Bandcamp or wherever you posted it, but I listened to one of them. But I remember one of them, like when you were first writing it, and I think that you were probably writing it back in the Hadley days. Just for some context, long time ago in when I was a student, this is context for you, this is context for the audience. Back in the old student days, my friends lived in a house in Hadley, Massachusetts, and we were all about, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old. And Tom moved in. Tom's a little bit older than us, and we just thought, Tom, this guy Tom, like, He just got back from Los Angeles. Like, he's really good musician. He plays guitar. He's seen it all. He's done it all. We're kind of in awe and very glad that you wanted to move into the house.
I know. And then like soon after, you learned that I actually wasn't straight from Los Angeles. I had actually been living on my friend Leslie's couch in Amherst for a couple months and driving for Domino's Pizza. So kind of not a very rock star ending to a rock star.
Or is it though? But is it? I think but that's kind of the thing. Like, we were all in awe of your abilities, and rightly so. You have remarkable abilities, but also, you know, you had done stuff. And let's put it this way: we were a bunch of guys who valued the experiences that you had accumulated, and it was fun for us, but also you knew all the rock guys in Western Mass, and like that, now we know all the rock guys in Western Mass.
Yeah, and now we're all just old, so it doesn't even matter. But I would say the ones of us that are still alive are still making music. That's great. It makes me happy that I live here still, you know.
But that song in particular, the song that I'm thinking of is Electricity.
That was old. I think I had like an old demo version of that. That I don't know if someone else sang on. I don't think I had ever quite found someone to sing on it, though. She said he did not sing on that one, but there was another girl.
So I feel like I heard a recording of it, and I was like, dude, I know that song.
There was a recording of it. It might have been me, like, singing falsetto for the part or something. Yeah, eventually there was a woman from upstate New York that I randomly just, like, posted something on Craigslist or something that said, looking for a female vocalist, but, you know, here's what I'm trying to do.
Right.
And she just came out. I paid her a couple $100 and she learned a couple songs. I think she did at least two or three songs, actually. And she did them pretty well. I think I'm going to try to remember her name. Kylie, I think her name was.
I'm sure it's on the site.
She did a few songs and she did the electricity song as well.
Nice.
Which is like rife with like outre sexual innuendos, but
well, I remember you saying specifically, it's like, this is a dance pop song. I want to sell it to someone like Paula Abdul or something.
Totally. Well, you know, I had met Paula Abdul when I was in LA, and I was like, if I could just get Paula Abdul could do this song, it'd be perfect for her. But I neglected to get her phone number when I met her out there. So that
always been, be networking.
Yes, I know. See, I should have, because the time that I met her in the lobby of this law firm out there, and I was waiting to see somebody and she was waiting to see somebody, and there was another guy there who was also like a songwriter who was just like instantly networked. You know, he was just over to her and was like, here's my card. Please, she's like, you can call my manager if you got a song, whatever. And I was just like,
hey, Paula Abdul.
I was never good at the business part of music.
No. I feel like most people probably aren't.
Some people are a lot better at that than they are at the music. So that explains the general mediocrity of a lot of American music.
Boom.
What matters to you, you know?
Nah, for real. But yeah, as far as like, I've always known you've had different jobs as far as I've known you. You've worked at the Advocate, which is like the culture newspaper, which is pretty cool job. For a job, that's a pretty cool one, right?
It was a pretty cool one. It paid terribly.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, you know, for someone who's like a single guy with housemates, it was fine. You know, I did have some form of bad health insurance and
it's better than no health insurance.
And there were a lot of perks too, you know. You got a lot of free tickets to cool shows and stuff, so, you know, I saw right a on. Lot of, you know, I got a lot of pairs of $60 tickets for free and got to see a lot of great shows at the Calvin and the Iron Horse and the wherever else, Mountain Park. I saw the Flaming Lips there. That was awesome.
Oh cool.
And a couple other shows there. Willie Nelson. I got to be up on stage with Willie Nelson randomly, just like.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, my friend John, who's in the Stone Coyotes, I was like, we ran into him and he's like, come on, well, let's go up backstage. We'll be Willie Nelson. So we got to go up. We just stood on the back of the stage while he was playing. You know, the guy's like 80 years old.
Yeah.
And the sad reality is he has this huge digital clock like facing up at him like a monitor that's like ticking down, telling him how many more minutes he has to play.
Oh, that's kind of weird.
Well, yeah, when you're 80 years old, it's like, all right, almost there. Just a couple more songs and I can get back to my trailer.
Got to get the electrolytes.
Hey, if I'm still doing that when I'm 80, I'll be very happy.
Well, you probably will be.
If I'm 80, if I make it to 80.
You could actually just grow out your beard and put snacks in it. And you could be like real snack beard.
Extra scary snack beard. Extra. Like extra creepy
the
guy.
Stuff that nightmares are made of.
Yes. Yes. Something out of a Stephen King book.
So, all right. So you've worked all these different types of jobs and embrace what they all have to offer. But as far as I know, you want to be a musician when you grow up, and you are a musician. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say that you aren't a musician. You are a musician.
For my whole life, and well, not my whole life, but since I've been 12 or something, you know, my son is 12 now, and he's been a musician longer than me. Well, he will have been longer than me because he started taking lessons when he was like 9 or 10. So,
from somebody other than you.
Yeah, no, we hooked him up with a really cool music school that's right downtown in East Hampton here. And he learns a interesting variety of stuff that's clearly somewhat designed just to teach him how to play the instrument and also just to sort of get his head all over the place. He works mostly on like jazz stuff, jazzy sort of bluesy stuff and an occasional slightly classical type piece or something, but
Did you take, lessons? Because I remember back in the Hadley days, I don't know, after the bars closed or whatever, one night we were sitting, I don't know why, it was just the two of us at the Hadley house in the living room, and you were playing this stuff and explaining very intense music theory to me.
I'm not helpless in music theory. I understand intuitively. I understand a good bit of what's going on in music theory. Uh-huh. I'm just sort of illiterate, you know, like my actual music reading skills are like at a third grade level. Like my son reads music far better than me at this point, because that's how we initially learned it, you know, and I took guitar lessons for a couple years, maybe, when I was his age, and I learned how to read like chord charts and stuff like that, and a little bit of reading actual staff music. But mostly, since then, I've just learned everything by ear, and my ear got really good, and to the point where I can just sit down and listen to a song and probably figure out how to play it, like. Just by listening to it once.
You know all the songs, by the way. I mean,
I get it. Yeah, I've got like, they used to call me the human jukebox.
For real.
Because I show up at a party and whip out any ridiculous song, you know, one hit from the 80s that you always wished you could forget, but is still there in the zeitgeist.
Right.
But my reading skills were never phenomenal, and I never made a huge effort to improve them. So I think like once you learn so much the other way, like when you've already learned how to do this by ear so well that you don't really need that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
if you're not playing with an orchestra and you're not getting not in the Saturday Night Live band and they're not handing you out like the pages for the performance tonight, then who cares?
Right.
If you're just playing with dudes who also have the skills that you have, then you just feel it out and then it happens.
Yeah,
right.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's how it works. And who knows what Emmett's my son, who knows what his musical life will evolve into. But he has started playing in a couple of the school jazz bands.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that's sort of exposing him to playing with other people, you know, not just sitting and practicing in his living room.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also, I mean, learning to read the music, of course, it's a good skill to have. I mean, most of the musicians I know don't know how to do it, but it's still a good skill to have. But when I was in high school, I was in a band, and the guys in my band were in the jazz band as well. You know, like I think that might be a key component to getting people started playing in rock bands and when they're in high school, like because they're in those situations that they make the move pretty easily. It's a good place to learn those chops, I think. It's fun.
I hope so. Well, I hope it's, I mean, his, you know, living through this pandemic and everything, like his biggest challenges have been social, you know.
How old is he?
He's 12 going on 13. And he's, you know, at least the last 3 years of his life have been drastically affected by pandemic and also just by the proliferation of the screens, you know, like it's all, there's just, he's so kind of addicted to the screens, and I'm always trying to cut him back on that and try to get him to do different things. And it's hard, you know, all the kids are the same way. It's not just him. It's just like everybody. I don't know about you. How old are your kids?
9 and 11. I don't know. I don't think it's not as bad as some, but I can see it. Like they don't have their own phones or anything, but we have an old phone with games on it and stuff and they play with that. And then we have a really old, crazy, crappy iPad that they play games on, and they play these stupid browser-based games on the laptop. I don't understand why they want to do it, but hey, it's not my choice. But they're like super. They almost always ask before, like, can we do this? It's like, sure, okay, go ahead. But I feel like with my oldest daughter, she's going to be 12 in September. I feel like the floodgates are about to open and it's going to get crazy. But
yeah, Emmett does not have a phone either, but he does have a an iPad, which he's just always he watches like YouTube video. And you know what he does? He watches YouTube videos of dudes playing video games and just
oh my god,
talking,
why
talking?
I don't
about
understand.
It. It's like and it's like all his friends do the same thing. It's like they watch these YouTube videos of these and in some ways like. You know, the entrepreneurial guy in me is always kind of amazed on some level by like that. I like this. You know, you look at this guy and all he does is play video games and record himself mm-hmm. babbling about it. He's 22 years old and he has like
he's 3 not
million,
even funny.
He's got 3 million followers and like and, you know,
I know.
You Google these guys and they have like a net worth of like $20 million.
It's insane.
I'm like, how did I not figure that out? You know, like, I guess I just missed that instinct or whatever. I mean, they do make a lot of videos. They're very productive. So,
yeah, it's not like they're not putting the work in. It's just I don't understand why that work is valued. I just don't get it. I also don't understand why you wouldn't just want to play the game yourself.
Right. Well, they do play the games themselves, too. But I think that's part of the reason why they do it is. They can bond like with the number one, like sometimes they'll learn like tricks and things that help you get through the game. And then,
okay.
And then
the other
part is sometimes the guys will do like really silly things in the game, you know, like they'll just like
off script things,
you know, whatever, you know, all of a sudden there'll be like 500 orcs, like having a picnic or something. And they'll just do these ridiculous things like just for the sake of doing them.
right. what is his instrument of choice? What's his instrument
piano.
Of choice?
He plays piano.
And do you guys have a piano in the house, an actual piano?
Do I actually just paid it off like a real, I bought a brand
Dude.
New acoustic piano. I've been wanting to have one of those my whole life. Actually had one for a while that I got for free, but it was just a terrible, I mean, it was a junker and it was just impossible to keep in tune and, you know, pretty mm-hmm. much beat to hell. But this is a brand new Yamaha, sounds great. A guy I used to do work for, a piano tuner friend of mine, comes and tunes it whenever needs it. And I just paid it off. So it's like, it's all mine. It's a brand, like,
that's amazing.
Couple of years old and I'm very grateful to have it, not only for my own satisfaction, but because he plays it all the time.
Right.
So,
of course. What does he also look? This show. I asked you on, but I'm actually curious about what the kids are into as well. So, but considering that he's a young burgeoning musician and he and his specialization is keys, does he make beats and do MIDI stuff on the computer?
Not yet. I could see him getting into that. So that may happen in the next few years. Yeah. We'll see. Yeah, he definitely has the skills. That he could probably start doing that.
Oh, for
that.
Sure.
I do,
if you
I have
a, musical knowledge, like learning the way the computer stuff works is easy.
Yeah, and I have a great, I have this, what I'm recording on right now, which is, let me see if I get it, it's Acid Pro Suite. It actually comes with a zillion different beats and samples. And I mean, like literally half of the dance pop stuff that I make, I build in loops. I'll layer probably like 8 different drum loops and rhythm tracks. And sometimes I'll put like a live bass on it or I'll take a sampled bass and I'll edit it and meticulously pitch shift it and stuff so I can create melodies or bass lines or whatever. And then there's, you know, all sorts of synth loops and pads and stuff. And you can really build, you can build a lot just even without ever plugging in an instrument.
It's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. So one of these days I'll try to turn him on to that and see if he's interested in
latches on to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what does he listen to? What are kids his age listening to?
Unfortunately, his favorite kinds of music is like this just modern pop stuff, which is, you know, I'm trying to think of.
Probably won't even know, but.
I don't know. Like, you know, just the top 40 stuff, basically, like The Weeknd
I mean, I kind of know that because
he was very into Imagine Dragons for a little while
I couldn't get into that, but
I've been exposed to them enough to like be able to find some value in their skills sure. and talents.
I think they're good. I just don't like it particularly. Yeah. You know, I don't care.
But he loves it. And a lot of it's very melodic and features, you know, very good singers. And
yeah,
he sings along with it. So I'm happy for that. And you can hear him sing in the shower. He likes to memorize. Nice. Like he also loves Eminem. Like he loves to like memorize like a zillion rap lyrics. And
totally.
He's pretty good at it. So that's part of his raison d'etre as well musically.
That's pretty cool. It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. I don't know that my kids are that interested. Like all their whole lives I've been making mixes and trying to expose them to things, and then the stuff that they end up latching onto, I'm just like, oh, it's just, I just can't handle it. It's, and I don't want to discourage them, but it's often very difficult to hide my revulsion because it's just so bad.
Well, there is there are a handful of like interesting innovators like that come out every year or two.
Yeah.
And Emma likes some of those too, like the Lil Nas X he likes, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He has like three names, but he made that really freaky video where he gets killed in a parking garage. I can't remember his name.
It doesn't matter. I just know, like, I'm definitely not the target demographic, and it shows. And it shows. But I have been trying to broaden my horizons. It's just one of the things I do.
Yeah.
And I want to know what the kids like, because I want to hear what they're interested in, you know? Like, I try to figure out why. Like, sometimes I understand why, I just don't like it, and then sometimes I really don't get it at all. But it's also like, you know, like there are guys out there like Kanye, and I straight up don't understand. But I also, I'm not even talking about like his anti-Semitism. And
I
all
think
that
he's
stuff.
Just like, crazy. You know, he's just like, I, well, that's, one of those
like, but,
people.
Like,
that's
is he crazy
like...
or like, I, is it just because he's crazy? Like, I really don't know. But like for a while, I was just like, I don't know what's going on here, but I feel like there's value.
Kanye has made some great records when he back in the day, but now he's. I feel like he's crazy by virtue of being famous for X number of years. You know,
just
like
being too removed from the rest.
What
of
happens?
Us.
Yeah, it's what happened to Michael Jackson. Happened to like so many people, and yet they just start living in this bubble reality, and like only certain pieces of information pierce their bubble, and that begins to shape them into these bizarre people that really have no idea like what's going on in the world, like for most people. So that's what I think happened to him. I'm unaware of Kanye's origins, so I don't know where he comes from, but I do feel like he used to not be so crazy.
It's kind of like, you know, sometimes you go to you see art and you're just like, I'm pretty sure this is legit, but I don't know why.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what art is supposed to do to you, right?
Like, right, exactly. Like,
there's something there, but you can't really explain it. And you're
don't
like,
ask me to tell you.
Yeah. Which, you know, contraindicated by the many art history classes I took in college.
But that's their job. Their job is to ensure that they and their people have a job.
Right. Exactly.
In perpetuity.
Yes. If we can't explain it to you, then you'll never understand.
Yeah, it's just not true. But it's still, I love art history classes. I used to sit through them all the time when I worked at Wellesley. I used to be like AV guy, so I would support all the lectures and all the visiting artists and all the visiting lecturers. And so I sat through hundreds of lectures while I was there. And it's like, it's very enriching.
I'm sure you absorbed quite a bit of knowledge. Yeah,
I did. I've also forgotten a lot of it, but still it was good exposure, but you know, whatever. It's good to expose yourself to things, even if you don't like them, I suppose.
Yeah, probably.
So when did you get your first real six string, and was it at the Five and Dime?
Was not at the Five and Dime. It was at Swarthmore Music, where I grew up in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It was a Hagstrom hollow body. It was pretty
nice,
jamming guitar. Like, it's actually like probably considered vintage now, but at the time it was like a $60 guitar that my parents bought for me. So it was like a hollow body, huge guitar that, you know, you could play acoustic or electric because it plugged in. It was it's probably too big for my 12-year-old body. There's a picture of me somewhere having that guitar. But yeah, that was my first real six string, and then that went along with a year or two of lessons upstairs, nice. Like via the music store. I think they had their
that makes sense.
My first guitar teacher's name was Chip, and I'm gonna guess he was probably around like 26 or 27. Mm-hmm. But he looked older because he had like a big mustache and like crazy sideburns. And, you know, after the requisite like Iron Man or Smoke on the Water, like the first right. songs I learned on the guitar, he taught me some other things that were a little more interesting. I mean, he was a big Jackson Browne fan. He taught me how to play Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult. And,
nice. Classic.
And then for whatever reason, I don't know if he left or something. I only took lessons with him for maybe 8 or 9 months, and then he left. I'm sure he had a band or something too and went off and was doing stuff. Then I got this other guy who was sort of like an older, I don't know if I'm going to say he was like a vaguely Italian guy who was very into like this classical sort of flamenco guitar stuff and could just rip it like nobody's mm-hmm. business. But he was a terrible teacher. He would like I would go to him and like literally I would sit there and watch him play like Eddie Van Halen like classical guitar riffs or something, and
yeah,
and I'd be like, wow, you're really great. And he's like, all right, see you next time. That'll be another $25 or whatever, you know. Like
that is a terrible teacher.
I did not really learn anything from that. So I didn't last all that long with that guy. And then I pretty much after that I just was self-taught after that, you know. I just would literally, I was like the kid who would sit, I had like a turntable and I would sit there and move the needle back like 100 times to figure out like a Jimmy Page guitar solo.
Uh-huh.
And I did that on many a record. So that was the beginnings of my guitar existence.
What made you want to start playing guitar?
I will tell you, Jim.
Thanks.
This is probably not uncommon either. But so, well, I mean, everyone thought guitar was cool at the time anyway.
Yes, indeed.
But at the same time, like it was literally so like Eddie Van Halen was like my hero. By sheer coincidence, Valerie Bertinelli on One Day at a Time was like the biggest TV crush for me.
And totally.
When I saw that Eddie Van Halen was marrying Valerie Bertinelli, I was like,
"That's
I
what you got
to
do."
How to play guitar, man. I got to if I could learn how to play guitar, then I could be Eddie Van Halen, and I could get the girl like Valerie Bertinelli.
Yeah,
so that
true.
Is the inglorious inspiration of why I started playing guitar.
Yeah, Valerie Bertinelli is the face that launched 1,000 ships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe launched 1,000 guitar players too. I don't know.
Yes, and of course we're going to talk about the new record. I actually emailed you before I got the publicity spam, but I was reminded to follow up because of the publicity spam for the new record, which yeah. I've listened to a few times.
Oh, I'm glad that you've listened to it. Not that anyone actually owns a CD player anymore, but but I did just get CD. I ordered like 100 CDs. It was like, I think it was like $150 or something. And
mm-hmm. Oh, really? $150?
Yeah, just to send out for promos and like, smells freshly printed. Yeah. I don't know. There's something about it that I like just because it's physical.
Of course. Of course. So I listened to it on the website. I think there's a link in the email you sent out, and yeah. I will include that in the show notes. And I listened to it on Tidal as well. So if I don't know if you can see the stats, but if you see the Netherlands, that's me.
Okay. Like I can see. Well, I can see when my like royalty statements come through. They'll be like,
oh yeah, 2 cents from the Netherlands.
And not even. It's like 0 cents. It's like a half of them are like literally 0 cents for like even for like multiple streams. But
right.
I think actually the European ones actually pay you a little bit more for some reason.
Okay.
And maybe they just have some law that's a little slightly more respectful of artists or something. But
like this much more.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I'll do? I'll try to make an effort to just leave it on repeat.
Yeah, leave it on
whenever
repeat.
I leave the house.
Yes, if you have any algorithmic skills of programming stuff, so that like everyone is always listening to it. Or
if I had algorithmic skills, people would be listening to this podcast.
Right. Well, I'm fully expecting to be famous in Europe because of this podcast.
You're going to get the Turbert bump. Yeah, don't hold your breath. someone's gonna, I know that someone's gonna listen to it. I mean, there's a handful of people who listen. Thank you guys, you're the best. What else do I got here for you? I got you started playing guitar. How long have you actually been writing songs?
Oh geez, I think I've been writing songs since I could put three chords together, really. Like other than Valerie Bertinelli, my primary need for being a musician is to express myself. So I've definitely,
yeah.
And I like words too. So I've, you know, that art of lyric writing has evolved alongside my knowledge of making music and melody and stuff. Yeah, no, I've always been writing. Like literally, I wrote some terrible songs when I was like 14 years old. And
I can imagine, but you know, good on you though.
yeah. Thankfully, I don't really remember those. But but there's also like probably great songs that I've written that I don't remember, unfortunately, because I never recorded them or never, you know,
right.
wrote down in any or lost the lyrics or something. And
mm-hmm.
I like to think that that is like sort of self-selection or whatever, but. Yeah, I still have plenty more. I probably still have 60 or 70 decent songs that I'd still like to record that haven't been recorded yet. Thankfully, I don't write at a pace like I used to. Like in my 20s, I'd write a song like every week or something. And now I'm lucky if I write like a song every year.
Well, that's a different pace, but it's still, you got a cache of songs.
Yeah.
That's what
I'm catching up, you know, and like this record, the Vegas Nerve Reset record is not all, but almost all the songs were written literally probably 25 years ago.
And okay, interesting.
So about, I don't know, like a dozen years ago or so, I went and recorded a whole mess of them, probably 25 or 30 songs, just in acoustic guitar and vocals. Bit just like basic tracks in Mark Miller's studio, which at the time was Slaughterhouse in West Hampton, it was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just sat on the shelf for a decade plus. And then, you know, when I ran out of pirate or dance projects, I was like, wow, what do I want to do now? And I was like, why don't I do this? And Mark still has all these tracks. So I was like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to like flesh them all out.
Yeah.
So that's what I did with this record. I just basically gradually over the course of the last year put bass on them, put more guitars on them, played drums on them, played keyboards and whatever else, did extra vocals and backing vocals and kind of really fleshed them out from just these raw vocal and acoustic basics. And I have a whole other album's worth that I'll probably do in the next year that'll be the rest of this project. There's still a deep well of stuff I can draw from. I'm not alarmed that I'm not writing songs at the pace that I used to.
When you moved in with the guys in Hadley, one of the things that we learned from you, I know I learned from you, I'm going to say we, because I know that some of the other guys latched onto this as well, is you have this deep appreciation and understanding of the pop song as an art form. And I feel like guys like us, like Ed, Andrew, these guys,
mm-hmm.
we were like dismissive of a lot of pop music. When we were introduced to you and your song craft, and I feel like you infused pop music back into our lives. Maybe we had an appreciation for it when we were younger. And then you came in, you're like, no, man, this stuff is great. It's like magic. I can hear your influences and but also just like the magic of the hook. And the magic of the turn of the phrase, the cleverness of the turn of the phrase, I feel like that's one of the things that you gave me a deeper appreciation for, and I really thank you for that.
You're
because
welcome.
I feel like it was a very cynical time in rock music, and like being reintroduced to the joy of pop music, I feel is like a thing. I can remember talking to other people, not in my immediate circle of friends, like what was it when Jack White was the cool guy, and he started working with Brendan Benson, and they're like, people are like, who's this Brendan Benson guy? And then they go and they listen to a Brendan Benson album, and Brendan Benson's like pure pop magic, like mm-hmm. pop magician. And these people are dismissive of it. And I was like, hold on. Guy's awesome. Like, this guy's a ninja. I feel like for some people, you have to explain to them like the importance and the art of pop music. Maybe you have some thoughts about that.
Well, that's why I started working on some of these dance pop, because I just literally wanted to, I mean, honestly, half the time I make any kind of record, no matter what sort of genre it's in, it's just to see if I can do it, you know? And like, it gives me an excuse to study a whole new kind of music and like explore it and absorb it and like try to reproduce like the elements of what makes that a great thing, you know, like, you pick apart like Britney Spears' Toxic, such an amazing song, like every little element of it, every little twang of like 2 seconds of surf guitar that they put in the song, or like, it's just everything about it is great. And you can sit there and pick apart every little production thing that they do in it, and every little writing thing they do with just like the turn of phrase or the music or the melody or the bass line or whatever. But, you know, all that stuff goes back to Burt Bacharach and Carole King and like the know, people that used to sit in the Brill Building and write songs for everybody.
Geniuses.
Yeah, you know, you never know. Like Carole King was like 16 when she started working at this place, and she probably wrote songs that Sammy Davis Jr. was singing at some point, you know,
which is crazy.
It's just very bizarre, you know, but it's like, but it does speak to like the art and the value of writing and constructing pop songs. And, and yeah, that's very valuable to me. It's very, I don't know why, you know, I often go back to what John Lennon said one time, which I really always respected, was, and this is from a guy coming from a relatively blue collar, you know, background, who was like, pop songwriting is more of a craft than an art. It's like being a plumber or something. You know, you're good at it because you learned how to put things together right. And that's pretty much what it was to him. And that's kind of, I mean, I think eventually it became a little more than that to him, you know, once he started, you know, putting mind expanding
his
things
mind
in his body, and like, you know, this the whole nature
hanging out
of,
with conceptual artists,
the whole nature of everything sort of changed. But
right.
But up until then, like his mind was very structured, and he was a craftsman. He was writing songs like he was building a birdhouse or something, you know.
Right.
And I always respected that sort of analogy and related to it, just because that's how I fancy myself, more of a craftsman than a true artist. As far, you know, I'm not like Bjork over here. I'm not like I'm not like exploring the
kind of like
edge
Bjork.
I mean, kind of, but you know, prettier.
Pop music is a big thing, and I love it. And some of the new songs on the record, I should have it up here so I could see the titles, but there are two. I think it's the first one that, I mean, you always start off with a strong one, which is a good idea to do. There are a couple, like you bring the tempo down, but then it's like the fifth or sixth track, Canary, I believe it's called. I like that one. Those are the standouts for me. There's two in the first three songs that I think, are like super strong. It's almost like Carsy,
I'm into
pop
that
songs.
Sort of pop rock sort of, and honestly, I appreciate the feedback, because I like, someone asked me, one of the friends of mine that has a local radio show here asked me like, what's the hit, you know, what's the single? And I couldn't answer him. I was like, you know, I don't know if there is a single on this record. I like, hopefully there is, but I don't know what it is.
I'm gonna go with Canary off the top of my head.
Okay,
but I think it's because I like the lyrics. And right now I can't tell you, I don't remember exactly what it is, but I feel like it's, I remember at the time being like, oh yeah, no, I relate to this. I think this is good. I understand. It's like, but there's also like the double meaning of the canary in the coal mine and the learning to sing and like stage fright or whatever. Like there's a lot of stuff going on there. Anyway, I liked it. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah, like I like that one too. That's definitely in contention for if there is a single on there. But I don't know.
That's my pick for a single.
You know, I put Kennel, which is the first song, I put that first because it sounded just kind of like poppy and sing-songy enough to be, you know, like a catchy something, like, and doesn't have any bad words in it, you know. It's just a weird allegory, but like
it draws you in.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to it, probably like 85% of these songs are just about a girl, you know, but there's a couple that aren't, that are a little more sophisticated maybe, but yeah. Into the Sea, as this is sort of a departure. It's like a, I called it my fake Celtic song. It was sort of the working title because that's more just a sort of a deeper reflection on the state of the world, I guess, and
all right.
The way that people look at life. Well, and then there's some things that are about a girl, but not the way you think. Like the second song, Susie Somebody, it was very disturbing, actually. It was about this woman I met in L.A. who was drop-dead beautiful. She lived in, like, the other half of this little guest house that I rented in Silver Lake for a little while, and she just told me her whole life story, and it was so tragic, but I would give her a ride to drive. She didn't have a car, even though she lived in L.A., which is, like,
insane.
How can you not have a car when you live in L.A.?
Yeah.
But so I would give her rides and drop her off at these crazy parties in, like, Beverly Hills and stuff, and she'd be like, thanks, I'll see you. But in the meantime, like, she would tell me her whole fucked up story of how she grew up in Texas. Her father, like, murdered her mother.
Dude.
She was, like, every possible tragedy you could think of, like, happening right. to a girl, like, happened to her. And then she came out to L.A. and started modeling, basically, like, because she was so beautiful. And by virtue of that, sort of got into this scene of parties and whatever, you know, modeling and probably occasional, you know, acting gigs of someone who doesn't necessarily have acting skills, but is very good looking. So
if they look good on screen.
Yeah.
It's
so
important.
That song is about her and just the whole idea of how someone, because there were a lot of people like her in L.A., like that had just grown up in some fucked up, you know, childhood in rural America, and for whatever reason made their way to L.A. because it was like a dreamland for them,
sure.
and they were gonna make it there or something. I mean, myself among them, but you know, with a less tragic childhood.
I want to talk about the desire to make a hit.
Uh-huh.
You've been doing this for a long time, and I think it's fair for me to assume that your main passion in life is creating music.
That's definitely in the top two or three. Yeah.
And I know that earlier in your career, you went through phases of having a band or like really kind of going for it and like doing the publicity thing and, you know, making a go of the thing. But eventually you have to come to the conclusion that maybe that's not going to work out some point, for better or for worse. Yet you keep doing it.
Yes, that's called the curse of the artist, or the something to that effect. Where
that's kind of what I'm, like, getting at.
It's kind of like you kind of can't stop doing this. It's not like something that you want to do. It's something that you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you ever make a penny at it in life or not, you still need to do it, because that is the way that you've found to maintain your own sanity and to express your, you know, anything that you're trying to express that maybe you don't express very well in other ways. So,
yeah.
So you need to do this. It's like therapy for you. And I guess, I mean, really that more applies to just the making of the music and stuff, and not so much the marketing, or which I still do that stuff too, just to mm-hmm. see if anything will happen. You know,
you never know.
I spend hours like building lists of up to date, like music journalists and radio stations and blah, blah, blah. And I solicit all of them with, you know, meager success usually, but mm-hmm. you know, I try all sorts of things, and I have a little more money than I used to because I do have a full time
work
job as well, and so sometimes I pay for little bits of promo service or whatever, mm-hmm. and see what that does, and you know, it's all just sort of an experiment, and the whole game, and the whole music business in general is just a crazy crapshoot, like for anybody, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously you have a leg up if you have $5 million in the bank and your name is Miley Cyrus.
That does help.
It's still, even with $5 million and being Miley Cyrus, you could still like completely be burning your money and not get a hit at all. You know,
it's
a whacked business because it's completely dependent on public opinion. And it's still, even as much as, you know, people have drilled down everything into these digital numbers and every, you know, it's still just hard to predict what connects with people, you know,
because tell me about there's, it.
It's a whole generational thing. It's a whole experiential thing. You know, there's no guarantee that anything you do, even if you've constructed a pop song according to every parameter that your AI public connector thing has told you, you need to include references to this, this, and the other thing and make it sound like this. And this was the biggest song that just happened a month ago and make it sound like that. And
yeah.
Even if you do all that, you're just not guaranteed to connect with people. You know, connecting with people is a rare and beautiful thing still, even in the ugly music business. And it's still kind of a rare and genuine thing when someone really breaks through. And even if it's just someone wacky and
it usually is someone wacky, right?
I mean, sometimes, not, I wouldn't say usually, but
often enough,
you know, who the guy that comes to mind is that guy Psy, who is the Korean guy who did Gangnam Style.
Oh God, yeah, the guy's
wacky
insane,
ass
right?
Video, totally. Like they made up a silly dance to go along with it, but. No, but the
what I was thinking though was more like, so maybe you're not selling a million records, but you go out and you play gigs, and there's always like there, or not always, there's often like one dude at the show who really is just like super into it, like whether you know that guy or not.
There usually is, yeah.
He's all up in it, and you're just like, dude,
which is an
awesome.
Interesting phenomenon, yeah. And sometimes you like wonder how that happened, and
yeah,
like
is this guy crazy or are we connecting?
Right, probably both, but you know, that's all part of it too, because the value of connection is that you have written and produced something that when someone listens to it, they're like, wow, that's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
And when you do that for an entire generation at one time, then you're like Kurt Cobain or whatever, or you're, you know, or even if it's just for a minute, you're Psy with Gangnam Style.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I read this great interview with him who, you know, because he's clearly never been able to replicate that moment again himself, even, you know, he's never had a hit that came anywhere close to being that
sure.
big.
Sure. Not even in Korea.
I mean, he was already kind of a personality in Korea, but like when that happened, he was just like worldwide famous.
Yeah,
and
I think he had
never
like billions
attained
of hits on YouTube and stuff. Like
yeah,
billions.
Never attained anything close to that again in several songs that he's produced and put out since then. So now he does, you know, he's got a production company and works with other artists. And,
nice.
And, that's a cool thing too. That's something I'd love to do, you know, and I've sort of dipped my toe in that with writing these dance pop songs, just trying to, you know, trying to, and on some level, what I'm doing is, you know, basically making high quality demos that I've also sort of tried to pitch out in the songosphere of like, you know, publishing companies and people that whose job it is to find songs for bigger artists and stuff. So I've definitely sort of tried to pitch those songs in that context too, even though I've released them, you know, independently as well. But, you know, grand total of, you know, of under 1,000 downloads or hits or whatever, you know, streams.
It's tough.
Or, you know, someone could still definitely do any
of course.
Of those tunes. So if I find the opportunities, I'm still trying to pitch them to, you know, established artists, because that, from a songwriter's perspective, that's a great opportunity if you can get in on that gravy train.
Sure, sure, sure. Did you have the desire for some sort of, I'm going to say recognition or the expressive urge? When was that right from the start when you first started playing music, or was it, did you develop it over time? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know, that sounded kind of silly, but
like when I was a kid, you
yeah,
mean?
Like when you started playing, I know you wanted to, you were down with Valerie Bertinelli, but like as far as when you started writing songs and stuff, because let me just tell you why I'm wondering, because I've always had the urge to be heard. Maybe it's because in my house, I just felt like I wasn't being heard, or maybe I wasn't, you know, like for whatever psychological reason. I remember at an early age, before I really had any idea about actual art, I had ideas in my head about what art was, and I would sort of make these expressive drawing collage things with text and words and stuff, and they were super corny. Like, that was what my idea of art was. Like, I thought, oh, this is kind of weird and abstract. It's art. And I remember doing that when I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old. And I feel like that is not every, I don't think everybody does that. And I don't think that everybody writes songs.
Didn't.
No, but it's like a drive to express something, which can manifest in songwriting. It can manifest in painting. It can manifest in photography. It can manifest in whatever, carpentry.
I definitely. So I was like a visual artist before I was a musician. I was drawing since I was a very young child.
Okay.
I don't know how much expression I was putting into it because I was more interested in the techniques and I was a big fan of comic books and comic book art, and I used to try to draw everything that I saw in the comic books, and
nice.
I had my favorite comic book artists, and mostly they were very realistically, you know, my favorite comic book artists were the ones, and my favorite, you know, once I got to college and stuff and studied like Renaissance art and every other kind of art under the sun, my favorite kinds of art were still realistic, you know, like they were, how well can someone illustrate accurately like what they actually see in front of them? And I was never much of an abstract person. I mean, later in life I came to appreciate things like that, but you know, via like Picasso and people who you can actually just see how their process from going from someone who knows how to perfectly illustrate a human body to reducing it to four lines, you know,
like, yeah, sure.
You can see that process in Picasso, and it evolved over his life, and that's interesting to me. But what I always like to note is that, you know, before he reduced the human body to four lines, he could perfectly render one in an extremely realistic fashion. So you can't just start with four lines. I mean, not to say that you can't, but I have much more respect for the fact that he chose to reduce
sure.
the motion or the body to that after having extensively studied how to realistically render it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first love. I sat around drawing comic book arts and stuff, and I don't know how much I was expressing at that point. I think I was just learning techniques.
But it seems like it carries over into your thing. Like before, you mentioned that the mechanics and the structure of creating a pop song, it's like nuts,
right.
nuts and bolts. And
yeah.
It's like building
more of a craft.
A foundation. Yeah, more of a craft is what you said.
Yep. I think, if anything, I probably find more art. I mean, there's definitely art in constructing a pop song. Like,
sure, there is.
Knowing how melodies fit over chord progressions and rhythms,
mm-hmm.
there's definitely art there just as much as there is science. And same with, I think it's even more obvious in writing, like just the way that string words together, be it in a novel or a song or mm-hmm. a poem or whatever. There are definitely, I think there's even more room for art there because, you know, in music theory, there's probably only X number of combinations of notes and chords and everything and rhythms. Whereas in the English language, there's at least, 300,000 words or something.
I don't know.
that's more than there are options for constructing melody over chords and beats. So I think,
but
I
if
think
you ignore the theory and just make sounds, then it's infinite, right?
That's true. Well, and there's also, you know, Eastern sort of modes of music that have many more semitones than
sure.
than ours.
Sure.
I mean, you can do the same thing with language, though. You could be E.E. Cummings and never
That's right.
capitalize anything or use any punctuation, and
whether you're talking about literature or music or painting. I appreciate different artists for different reasons. Like I can appreciate the guy that's just 100% raw power and just blasts mm-hmm. out, you know, his damaged psyche. And then I can also appreciate the guy who woodshedded for 25 years and is a master
right.
of the craft. Like,
yeah.
It's like, and
no.
also with songwriting, it's like sometimes it's just like beautiful poetry, and sometimes it's just like words cut down to the most simple meaning that could possibly come from the word.
Yeah, and like Gangnam Style.
Like Gangnam Style. That's the...
if you know anything about what Gangnam Style is, where he comes from, the Gangnam is like this... It's like the posh, like rich people area of Seoul, Korea. It means a lot more than you think. Like, mm-hmm. it's not just a catchy thing to say. It's like there's a whole philosophy and or social statement behind Gangnam Style. You know, it's
right
like,
on
that we don't understand as like
Americans. I definitely don't understand it, but oddly addictive.
But yeah, I'm right there with you as far as like having a great appreciation for both things, the refined and the raw.
Yeah.
I think the best things are probably combinations of the two.
Sure. I think I might agree with you. It's hard to say the best things for me, but I agree. Much of the time, it's both.
Yeah. Yeah, well, some people would say you can ruin yourself, too. I've taken a lot of art history classes, too, and I go back to the story of Henri Rousseau, who never had art schooling and developed his own incredible style.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where, like, when he finally applied to art school, like, he had already had these contemporary painters and stuff who looked at his stuff and they were like,
blown
don't
away.
Go to art school, dude. Like, you're just gonna, like... You've made something incredibly cool all on your own here, and don't ruin it with art school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the same thing has happened. You know, I used to play in a band called Tag Sale. I don't know if you ever saw us play, but...
I certainly did, yes.
So most of the Tag Sale, or at least half of the Tag Sale songs, were written by this guy, Bob Jensen, who didn't know shit about music theory. Like, he wrote every song because he knew some bar chords on the guitar.
Right.
And he put them together however the fuck he felt like it. As a consequence, he wrote songs that no one else would have. I could have written those. Like, I would be like, that doesn't make any musical sense.
That's cool.
You can't do that. but he would just put them together however he felt like it.
Yeah. And well, that's a good lesson.
Really cool. That was the reason I stayed in that band for a couple years or whatever was because, like, he would just write these songs that I was like, wow, that's cool. Like, I could not have written that song.
Okay, so the big question for the podcast that I ask everybody is, do you feel successful? Which is very broad and vague question. Answer it however you like. We can whittle down the answer after the fact.
I mean, I absolutely feel successful as far as just in growing myself and developing my craft and having spent many, many years sharing this beautiful thing called music with many people, both people who listen to it and people who have played with me, people who I've played with their bands, and I would not have asked for another life. It's definitely, there's been plenty of drama and hard times, you know. It's not easy being a musician for a lot of your life.
No, it really isn't.
Definitely doesn't go with things like financial security or relationship security. But man, a lot of good times and a lot of just living life, not just spectating.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for all that. And I think I would consider all of that personal success in the sense of, you know, growth and understanding of yourself and what you're trying to do here on planet Earth. Sure would be nice to have a little, like, financial success. Other than the 0.02 cents that Spotify pays me every time someone listens to a song.
But if that were to come to pass, like, what does that even look like? Like indie rock star, or do you want to be like Mick Jagger?
I'm like too old for that. Well, I guess
Mick Jagger's way older than you,
80 or something. but he was famous when he was 20.
He was.
So.
He's been like he doesn't even know what it's like to not be famous.
I mean, it could take many forms. You know, I've had visions of Snackbeard becoming a minor children's music star.
For real, that seems like it could. It's a viable option, right?
I have a whole other concept, Jim, which whenever I find the time to make it. I have a series of like parody songs that I've written. They're completely tasteless.
Excellent.
And
people
want
love that.
I want them to be performed by another persona that I'm going to call Classic Brock. And you know, and as far as financial success goes, I'm not aspiring to like jet planes and five houses on tropical islands. Yeah, I don't need to be
that's
like
a bit
Roger
excessive.
Waters rich, you know. I'd be happy to be able to pay off my house, you know, and send my kid to college.
Yeah.
That would be my reduced financial aspirations as far as music goes.
Interesting example, though, Roger Waters, because like I'm sure he has more money than anybody has any right to have, but he also doesn't strike me as someone who lives an incredibly frivolous life.
I don't know.
I'm sure he has a sweet house and a really nice car, but I don't picture him having five houses. But
he's also 80, and he's on like his fifth like 25-year-old wife or
something. Oh, okay. I guess I just don't know enough about Roger Waters.
As deep of a guy as he clearly is, like he definitely enjoys the shallow fruits of rock stardom.
Right on.
But yes, he definitely has five houses and five wives and right. et cetera.
Five wives. Awesome.
But I don't need that. I don't need that level of I probably wouldn't even survive that level of wealth.
I don't know. That's another interesting thing, because I feel like one time we were talking and you were like, I feel like I'm a really young soul.
I am a young soul. But, you know, I live in an increasingly old body, so there's no getting around that, you know. Roger Waters probably also, in addition to his five houses and five wives, probably has like five stem cell milkshakes a day.
God damn, I wish I could really use one of those.
maybe he only looks like 50 or something, even though he's probably more like 80.
He's always been in pretty good shape. He's always looked pretty fit.
Yeah, there are those fruits of being wealthy, of access to those age-defying things where you go in and have your telomeres lengthened or something.
Vampiric blood transfusion.
Exactly. Totally.
to be rich.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure those things are available.
All right. Well, I guess that pretty much covers the main topics for the show. Emmett is your kid's name.
Correct.
Does he like your music?
I've been very careful not to like push it on him, and I've been careful not to push him into doing music. That I always wanted him to do stuff, and he definitely has musical skill that one would like to think came from me on some level. But I've never been pushy about it. That's why I like that he takes lessons with somebody else.
Sure.
And I've never been that pushy about my music, but I have played it for him on occasion, and I'll catch him singing it every now and then, because he has a brain like mine that will remember catchy song melodies.
They are catchy.
And songs.
I actually remember a time you were playing a gig in Cambridge, and you stumbled your lyrics, and because I heard the song so many times, I cued you in onto what the missed lyric was.
Oh my
you,
god!
You probably See, don't I remember ne- that, but
I need that.
They're very catchy, is what I'm saying. Is what I'm saying.
Good. I'm glad. I mean, so in that sense, I am successful. Yes.
you've accomplished the goal of the pop art
the songwriter, the pop songwriter. Yes, to get something stuck in your head and to make you remember something.
Do you ever jam with him?
Emmett?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have on occasion. Yeah, my favorite jams with him. I have an electric piano downstairs in our whole jam space. And I like to play drums and he can play piano. And that's my favorite jams with him. I have tried playing guitar while he plays piano as well. And it's a little harder. But we've had some good jams on occasion.
Nice.
Not frequently, but hopefully.
It must be very rewarding. It seems like it would be very rewarding.
It's definitely fun to connect that way.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
But yeah, I wouldn't say it's that frequent, but hopefully it will increase in frequency if he gets more into music as the years go by.
On a related yet frivolous note, who was the best guy you ever opened up for? Guy, best artist, best act.
I really don't know. I mean, like that goes everywhere from. I opened up for John Doe once in L.A.
Oh, that's fun.
Alligator Lounge. Who? I mean, I know a little bit of like acts and old stuff like that, but I'm not a super fan. But And I certainly wasn't when I got the gig opening up for him.
You're just like, awesome, cool.
Someone got me the gig, and me and my brother sat backstage and drank his beer and ate his food, and then played my little pop songs in front of his like deep like native LA dude set. I don't think he liked us, but I don't know. I can't say who was my favorite. Probably more just local bands like Playtopia or something.
Oh, yeah. Those guys were great.
They had some great moments.
I saw them open for...
They opened for Pavement.
That's the one.
Times.
Yeah, I saw them. I mean, I saw them in the Valley a lot, but then I saw them in Boston opening up for Pavement, which I thought was crazy. I was like, I mean, I don't really know these guys, but I kind of know these guys.
They sounded great. They had like a great presence and songs, and we definitely latched onto them a little bit because of the record was great too.
Yeah, it really was.
So that was fun. I mean, things like that are what I really get into, is like usually the experience for opening up for a bigger, more famous artist, it can be awkward and you know, you will kind of wind up not liking them as a result of it, because they're like, no, you can't sound check. No, you can't use our equipment. Everything has to be left the way it is for us. And you just get up there and sound like shit before us.
I mean, I sort of understand. I mean, not the you get up there and sound like shit bit, but I mean, I sort of understand, because they're like on the road going from here to there to there to there. And they just don't want to deal with all the external stuff from every local band in America. But
I get it.
But you know, have a heart, man.
Some are nicer than others, right. Let's put it that way. some are more understanding than others.
I bet.
I mean, it all depends on the day you have too, I guess. But I think for all of us, Jim, the key is to remember that, and I learned this from working at a hospital. Like, I watched a great video produced by the Cleveland Clinic that we had to watch at orientation when I just started working at the hospital, and it was such a great video. It just like panned around the hospital, and it was just various people. And then suddenly like a subtitle would pop up under a woman that said, going in for her 40th chemotherapy treatment or something.
Boom.
And it would cut, you know, pan over to another, a guy sitting there who's like a kid, like, and it would say like, father in heart surgery right now or something, you know, and you just don't know. Any person you meet could be going through some really hard stuff at any given time. And I think that as humans, we are obligated to realize that as we go through life, and every day realize that.
Right on. I was going to ask you if you had any parting wisdom, but you beat me to the punch.
That's my parting wisdom. Yeah, thanks to the Cleveland Clinic.
I'm going to look that one up on YouTube.
Oh, it might be out there. I don't know if it, I mean, it was literally an orientation video.
Yeah, no,
so I'm
not going to look it up.
But I think it is on YouTube, actually.
Hey, everything ends up on YouTube eventually.
Yeah, it was a great video, and it just really makes you think about, like, any assumptions that you might have about anybody at any given time. Right. Like just don't make assumptions, because you could be so completely, chances are you're completely wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, I guess we're done.
All right.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think so. I think you've done a great job of being a podcast host and extracting extracting whatever value I have to contribute.
I'm sure I missed up. That's just the nature of things. Nothing is ever complete.
Nothing is ever
that
complete.
That is both the folly and beauty of podcasting and life in general.
Yeah, no. Every single person that is on their deathbed, you know, their number one thing is, I'm not done. Is that all there is? I'm not done. I can't go yet.
Yeah.
So
that is true, or seemingly. Yeah.
Maybe not everyone. You know, people that have been suffering for years probably are happy to check out. But most people are like, want to do more. You know, and that's sort of the curse of human life.
Sure.
The way we've set up society, and like 95% of people are toiling away at things that are beneath their mental capacity. And that's how it is.
That is exactly how it is. That is not a very cheery way to end, but...
Sorry.
But...
And peace and love to everyone.
There you go.
God bless us everyone, Jim. You and me. And all the little children.
All right, cool. Thanks for coming on the show. I thought it was a lot of fun. I hope you had fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice. Good.
We be in touch.
Indeed.
Take care, brother.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Tom. It was really good to talk to him again. It's been quite a long while. You'd never know it due to the length, but I edited this one down a fair amount. Tom is the kind of guy I could talk to for hours. And I know some of you are out there saying, the episodes are too long. Yeah, I understand. They can be a little off-putting if the episode is longer than an hour, but I don't really see it as a problem. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I liked hearing Tom's thoughts about his son's musical development. They seem to have a healthy relationship. I also like that he mentions being artistically inclined as a child, but rather than being concerned with expression, he was concerned with the mechanics of drawing. And that ties in with the John Lennon quote he mentions about how pop music is a craft that one can learn and master, much like carpentry or whatever. Later on, or maybe it was before, he said that he was concerned with expressing himself. So it goes to show that people are an amalgamation of ideas and concepts and experiences and all that stuff. People are complicated, and you are no exception. Tom is no exception either. As an aside, I think it's kind of weird when you meet someone who does not seem complicated at all. It happens sometimes, and it makes me feel like I'm being effed with. You know, it makes me suspicious. But there is no evidence of foul play or ulterior motives. So then I get anxious because I wonder why my internal alarm bells aren't going off. But I guess they kind of are. Anyway, that has nothing to do with Tom. That can be another show. I also want to say that his response to the success question was a great one. All that about being content with his growth and his personal understanding makes me smile. Not that I can relate to it, but I envy and appreciate the optimism of his youthful soul. Of course, financial success would be nice, but ultimately, he seems to be doing pretty well. I realize we didn't talk about this much, but his jobby job sounds cool. He gets to make things for an institution whose main purpose is helping people maintain their health, and he has the time and means to make his own work and parent his kid. That's more or less the goal of a lot of artists I talk to or who I'm acquainted with. Also, he just paid for a piano, which is sort of like buying a car, so it's not a minor feat. I share your opinion that you are successful, Tom, and I hope that one of your projects will result in a later-than-expected career windfall. Listener, check the show notes for a ton of links. Tom gave me a few, and I tried to find as many as I could. You can search for Vagus Nerve Reset in your music streaming app. It's probably there. And make sure that you get the one with the brain and nervous system illustration. There may be another one that is a mindfulness / meditation soundtrack. That may be nice as well, but it's not what we're talking about today. I know it's on Spotify and Tidal. I did not check Apple, but it's probably there as well. In the list, I got a Big Ugly Wrench video. I got a Bandcamp link. Snack Beard is on YouTube. I found at least one song, Jolly Roger. SoundCloud.com/Tom-Sturm. You can find lots of his different projects there, including Sass and some older stuff. Anyway, go there. There are going to be hard links in the description of this episode. I will post some on social media as well. Additionally, I've dug up a little bit of archival footage at my place. I'm missing some key artifacts at this point, but I plan to find and exploit them so you can share in the joy of my revisiting some of the good old days. Thanks for being on the show, Tom. And many thanks to you as well, dear listener. I appreciate your time and dedication. It comforts me to know that you're out there. If you have a few extra minutes, perhaps you'd like to leave a 5-star review of Feel Free to Deviate on Apple Podcasts. I feel sort of dumb asking you to do that because I've listened to about 1 billion podcasts and I've never, ever left a single review. So I realize that it's a lot to ask. But you know what I have done? I recommend podcasts to people during casual or formal conversations. I humbly ask you to do both, just to be safe. Or do just one. Or none. Do whatever you want. You owe me nothing, but if you could just take a couple baby steps to make people aware of this podcast, I would really appreciate it. My links are feelfreetodeviate.com and buymeacoffee.com/feelfree. That's just feel free, no deviations. It's a quick, easy, and painless way to offset the cost of production of this very show. Also, I am at Feel Free to Deviate on most, but not all, social media networks. Coming up in 2 weeks is, I'm not sure. Your guess is as good as mine.
let me know if you want to be the next guest. And I'm only half joking. See you in a couple weeks. Goodbye.